Welcome to Speaking in Maine on MPBN. I'm Gordon Fellis. Today, our program will take us to Camden for a Mid-Coast Forum on Foreign Relations discussion. The speaker is Ira Glasser, longtime director of the ACLU and now president of the Drug Policy Alliance. His talk is entitled The War on the War on Drugs and will discuss the potential benefits of drug decriminalization. This program, as with all our Speaking in Maine programs, will be archived on our website, mpbn.net. There, look under the On Demand tab for Audio On Demand, where you can stream this program online or download as a podcast to take with you, a service made possible by member support. Introducing the speaker is Mac DeFord, president of the Mid-Coast Forum.
A very warm welcome to our radio audience from the Mid-Coast Forum in Maine. My name is Mac DeFord, and I'm the head of the forum, which was founded in 1983 by a small group of retirees living in the mid-coast of Maine with an interest in foreign policy. Our current membership of about 160 includes former diplomats, international businessmen, retired academics, and others with an interest in foreign affairs. For further information, please see our website at www.midcoastforum, all one word, .org. We have a monthly meeting on a Monday at either the Samoset Resort in Rockport or Point Lookout further up the coast to hear an informed speaker discuss a topic of international interest. Now today, we're delighted to welcome Ira Glasser. Ira Glasser has been a professor of mathematics and editor of a public policy magazine before spending 34 years at the ACLU. The last 23 as its national executive director. He retired in 2001 and currently serves as president of the board of the Drug Policy Alliance, a national organization devoted to developing a more rational drug policy. Since most of our speakers are experienced in foreign policy, Ira has asked me to mention that he makes no pretense of being a foreign affairs expert. We have often concluded in this forum that U.S. foreign policy would be much more sensible if the U.S. had a more rational drug policy. And Ira is here to tell us why such a policy would be domestically beneficial as well, and why current policy, drug policy, is dysfunctional and counterproductive. Ira Glasser.
Thank you. Last Sunday on HBO, some of you may have seen a new and very splashily advertised a series began called Broadway Empire. Boardwalk Empire, that's it. And it was a series about Atlantic City in the 1920s during Prohibition and the rise of the criminal gangs. The ad line, the tagline for this series was, when alcohol was outlawed, outlaws became king. And it is a story of the consequences of alcohol prohibition. Around the same time, a man named Dan Okrent, an accomplished author, the first public editor of the New York Times, recently published a book called Last Call, which was a very engaging and entertaining history of the rise and fall of the regime of alcohol prohibition. It was the result of 50 years of sustained, strategic, very sophisticated campaigning and entire organizations that grew up to carry those campaigns forward, the Women's Christian Temperance Union, the Anti-Saloon League especially, and had a very broad coalition of what today we might call right-wing fundamentalists, together with the left-wing progressives and socialists of the early 20th century. The coalition that came together to pass the Alcohol Prohibition Amendment was extraordinary in its diversity. And when alcohol prohibition became a fact on January 19th of 1920 and the accompanying statute, the Volstead Act, to implement it, there was huge celebrations in the land among all these constituencies that had worked so hard and so long to what they said, get rid of alcohol. They actually believed in their celebration that the production and the sale and the distribution and indeed the consumption of alcohol was now going to end. they believed it for about 10 minutes. Because it turned out that it did not end in any respect. The production didn't end. The sale didn't end. The distribution didn't end. And the consumption surely didn't end. The only thing that changed was the nature of the marketing system by which alcohol was produced, sold, distributed, and consumed. The nature of the marketing system changed dramatically. First of all, the people who did the marketing changed. They changed from the beer barons in St. Louis and the distillers in other cities into criminal gangs. Sam Bronfman, the man who ultimately was the head of Seagram's, got started in life as a Canadian bootlegger and made unbelievable fortunes because suddenly what happened was not only was the production, the sale, and the distribution not diminished, much less abolished, it was enhanced by the artificiality of the enormity of the profits that was now possible because it was illegal. That the criminal enterprise, the risk-reward ratio grew enormously. So that changed. The profits were immense. The marketers became criminals. That's what the slogan was when alcohol was outlawed, outlaws became kings. Criminal enterprises were institutionalized. And there were a whole host of other collateral effects that didn't exist as a result of alcohol, but were functions of the law that attempted to prohibit it. There was violence, unprecedented. Many people today think that the violence that attends drug prohibition is because people committing the violence are high. They are intoxicated on the drugs that they're using. That is not true any more than it was true that Al Capone killed people because he was drunk. The reason why violence becomes endemic under a regime of prohibition, of course, is because the law is no longer accessible to resolve disputes between sellers and buyers and among competing marketers for market share, for power, for control of market. When the law is not available, when you can't sue anybody, because you can't go into court, when you can't do mergers and acquisitions of rivals, when you can't take advantage of it, when you can't advertise and have competing marketing strategies, you settle disputes and you maintain market share and you maintain your power in only one way, in what John Locke called many centuries earlier, the state of nature. You shoot people. You kill people. Violence becomes the only way of resolving disputes when the law that regulates disputes in other commercial enterprises is denied. And that is one of the reasons why prohibition creates this tremendous problem. Prohibition also creates police corruption and judicial corruption in a way that could not exist on the same scale because the attempt to enforce prohibition brings the law enforcement institution into direct conflict with the very existence of the commercial enterprise. And the profits are so large, the money so immense, that bribery becomes institutionalized in a way that is almost unimaginable in a normal commercial enterprise. In looking back upon alcohol prohibition now, almost every serious student, virtually every serious student of alcohol prohibition will agree that it was a failure on its own terms in every respect. It did not demolish, eliminate, or even reduce production. It didn't reduce sale. It didn't reduce distribution, and it didn't reduce consumption. What it did do is it made that consumption more dangerous because now the criminal enterprises that were doing the marketing had an interest in maximizing the dangers of smuggling. So what they would do with alcoholic beverages is dilute them. The benign ones diluted them with water. The not-so-benign ones diluted them with toxic substances of all kinds that produced blindness, that produced insanity, that produced all kinds of strange things like One of the things that became very common in certain parts of this country was something called Jake Walk. They wrote folk songs about Jake Walk. Jake's Walk was the result of an impurity introduced to a certain kind of Jamaican rum that became very widespread. So the consumption became more dangerous to the consumer. In addition to the violence and the criminal enterprise and the police corruption and all the rest, the only things that changed as a result of alcohol prohibition was not what it intended to change, but the collateral consequences of the law. And the very worst features of prohibition were not caused by alcohol. They were caused by the law that attempted to prohibit alcohol. Apart from all of that, it also introduced a level of expansion of discretionary police power that came to violate individual liberties in a most fundamental and ubiquitous way. And I'm not talking just about the notion of you ought to have a right to put any substance into your body without the government poking around and telling you you can't. Forget that right. That's the fundamental principle. But John Stuart Mill and libertarians everywhere talk about personal autonomy and the right to do those sorts of things, the right to eat too much fat if you want it, the right to eat too much ice cream and red meat if you want it, never mind arteriosclerosis, the right to have too much cholesterol if you're foolish enough not to listen to your doctor. Nobody comes and arrests you in your own home or on the street for possessing unconscionable amounts of red meat or ice cream or even cigarettes, which, you know, the campaign against which has been almost entirely persuasive but not enforced by criminal law. Leave aside that right. What I'm talking about is something else. Normal crimes, assault, burglary, robbery, rape, are something that one person does to another person very much against their will. When those crimes are committed, there's a complainant, the victim. The victim lodges a criminal complaint. The police investigate. If you're lucky, they find the person who did it. Most often they don't, but that's the way the criminal law enforcement works. With a crime like prohibition, like prohibiting a certain substance, there is no complainant. I want to sell you alcohol. You very much want to buy it. We have a consensual agreement. Our only problem is we've got to avoid the cops. The police become the complainant in a crime for which there is no other complainant. In order for that to happen, the police have to intrude and find ways of intruding into essentially private, consensual interactions. Think of how the crime of adultery might be enforced. Adultery was a crime, as was sodomy, in many, many American states. Sodomy until very recently in more than half the states in this country. Think of how that would have to be enforced. It would have to be enforced by invading the privacy of the bedroom. And it was enforced that way. Certainly, sodomy involving homosexuals was enforced that way up until just a few years ago, in a case that reached and was upheld by the Supreme Court. In order to do that, you have to intrude in private arrangements. Wiretapping becomes an invention of alcohol prohibition. Wiretapping began in the 1920s in order to interrupt and intercept conversations that were otherwise private across telephone wires. And the very first case that challenged whether or not wiretapping was like any other intrusive search, subject to the restrictions of the Fourth Amendment, went up to the Supreme Court in 1928, right in the heyday of alcohol prohibition, against a man named Roy Olmsted, who was the person who was wiretapped. Roy Olmsted was a bootlegger. And wiretapping became instrumental and useful, and was literally an invention of alcohol prohibition. And the court decided that the only thing that the Fourth Amendment protected was the four walls of your house and the four walls of your business. But anything that happened outside was not protected by the Fourth Amendment, so they took the position that wiretapping was not restricted by the Fourth Amendment, by probable cause, by reasonable suspicion, by anything. And for 40 years after that, until 1967, when a different Supreme Court overturned that and established that wiretapping had to have a search warrant in order for it to be legal, wiretapping was without limitation. Cops could wiretap you anytime they wanted for any reason or no reason. That was a consequence of alcohol prohibition. In 1967, when the Supreme Court reverses itself and says a search warrant is necessary, in 1968, something called the Safe Streets and Crime Control Act is passed by Congress, and it authorizes wiretapping, but requires warrants and requires the government to keep records of the purpose of the wiretapping, the crime that was being investigated, how many conversations were intercepted, how many indictments were returned, how many people were arrested and convicted, and all that. If you go back and look at those reports for the last 42 years, you will find out that 85 or 90% of all the wiretapping in America outside of national security wiretapping is for drug investigations and some petty gambling before the states decided they should make that legal because it was a good revenue producer. Almost all of it has to do not with what you would call real crimes, but with conversations about drugs. And the number of intercepts of these conversations was vast, because when you tap somebody's telephone in order to find out if one of the people in that home is having a conversation about drug dealing, you get their conversations. You get the guy's wife's conversations. You get all of his teenage kids' conversations. And you get the conversations of everybody that calls them, any of them. So what you end up with is not the particularity that a search warrant usually has when they go into a house looking for particular contraband. You get a vacuum cleaner. And it sweeps up enormous numbers of conversations of entirely innocent people. And the percentage of arrests that emerge from those wiretaps as a percentage of the number of conversations that are intercepted is minuscule. And almost all of the convictions are for petty drug possession, not for anything that most people would consider a serious crime. Wiretapping is not used in rape cases and burglary cases and robbery cases. Think about how that would be. It almost never happens. So the surveillance mechanism, the intrusiveness of the police, as well as the corruption of the police, the intrusiveness of their penetration into private affairs becomes institutionalized during alcohol prohibition and stays that way for decades. Now, the analogy between what happened in alcohol prohibition, which starts in 1920 and ends in 1933 when everybody realizes what a failure it is and they want to get rid of the violence, and all the mothers who organized against alcohol to get prohibition, the mothers become organized to get rid of it because of the violence that began to affect their children and their neighborhoods. And in 13 years, it's gone. But drug prohibition stays. Drug prohibition is introduced around the same time in 1915 with something called the Harrison Act, but without a constitutional amendment. And it stays almost all the time. It never goes away. And it doesn't affect all that many people because, unlike alcohol, the other intoxicants are not used by that many people for a very long time. In 1970, the first war on drugs is declared during the administration of Richard Nixon. And in 1980, it's escalated again when William Bennett becomes Ronald Reagan's first drug czar. The explosion of the war on drugs on the fabric of this country is enormous. In the late 1960s, there were 200,000 people in this country in state and federal prisons for all criminal offenses. 200,000. Today there are 2.4 million, including 700,000 or so held in local jails. The single biggest factor in that explosive growth of incarceration is nonviolent drug offenses, mostly possession of small amounts. Not the major reason, not 50%, but the single largest reason, combined with the ferocious regime of mandatory minimum sentences that in the early 70s began to accompany drug violations, so that people were going away for 30, 40 years, 25 years, 90 years in some cases, for possession of small amounts of drugs, that these sentences dwarfed sentences for murder, for kidnapping, for rape or assault. The combination of the mandatory minimums that accompanied drug offenses, first in New York under the infamous Rockefeller drug laws in 1973 and in California, and became epidemic throughout the country, both federal and state, that combined with nonviolent drug offenses leads to this explosion. We now, with 5%, the United States has more per capita people in prison than any country in the world. With 5% of the world's population, we have 25% of the world's incarcerated population. Think of what that means when what you're talking about are things that most people will not consider serious crimes and crimes for which there are no direct complainants. I'm not talking about large-scale trafficking. I'm not talking about shooting people on the street or robbing people on the street to get money to buy for drugs. I'm talking about nonviolent drug offenses, which mostly involves possession of small amounts by nobodies. This continues unabated today. Since 1980 alone, the number of annual arrests for nonviolent drug offenses has more than tripled. We now arrest 1.8 million people a year for nonviolent drug offenses. Now, here is something that perhaps will surprise you. It certainly surprised me the first time I learned it. Nearly half of those are for marijuana. Surely the most benign intoxicant that has ever come down the pike, from which not a single person has ever died of an overdose, and which is certainly more benign than alcohol, certainly more benign than tobacco. But most of the enforcement is against marijuana. Nearly half the arrests are for marijuana. New York City, not Alabama, not Mississippi, not South Carolina. New York City is the marijuana arrest capital of the world. New York City arrests more people per capita for marijuana every year and has done so for the last 10 years than any place else on earth. In the decade between 1997 and 2006, begun by Mayor Giuliani, who was a known authoritarian, but continued and increased by Mayor Bloomberg, who was supposed to be liberal and benign, 35,000 to 40,000 people a year have been arrested for marijuana, small possession, small amounts in their pocket, a joint. In the 10 years before that, there were 33,000 people arrested in the entire 10 years, 3,000 a year. In the 10 years before that, did crime change during those periods? No. What changed was the policy. What changed was the policy. And these 35, 40,000 marijuana arrests happen in a state in which it is not a crime to carry around a small amount of marijuana in your pocket. It only becomes a crime if you display it, if you take it out and smoke it in public, or if you take it out and hold it. So how exactly do the cops execute these arrests? They do so with a vast regime of illegal searches. Accompanying these 40,000 arrests a year for marijuana in New York are upwards of 600,000, I think last year it was 583,000, stop and frisks on the street. The cops coming up to you, stopping you, frisking you, patting you down, putting their hands in your pockets, finding marijuana. Almost all those searches are illegal because under Supreme Court rulings of the last 40 years, you cannot, unless you have probable cause to arrest the person, you have evidence that they're committing a crime, that they're carrying contraband, you cannot just go up to a person on the street and even pat them down unless you have good reason to think that they have a weapon that is placing you in danger as a policeman. They claim that all these stop and frisks are for weapons. But when they stop you and they frisk you, these are all according to police reports that they file. God knows how many stops and frisks go on that are not written down and recorded by the cops. But the ones that are written down show that there were 583,000 stops last year, about that same amount the year before and the year before and the year before, and about something like 125 to 150,000 of those results in frisks and searches. And they say that they're doing this because they have reasonable suspicion of a weapon. The number of weapons recovered in those searches, about 750,000 in the last 5 years, is 0.37 of 1%. Now, you cannot, unless you're completely incompetent, you cannot have reasonable suspicion that somebody is carrying a weapon, search them for it, and then be wrong 99.63% of the time. That cannot be good policing. But that's what goes on. Now, the result of this in those incarceration figures are interesting. Since 1980 alone, the number of people in state prisons in this country who were there for nonviolent drug offenses has gone up from 6% to over 21%. The number of people in federal prison since 1980 who are there for nonviolent drug offenses have gone up from 25% to about 57%. The numbers are just vast. And during this same period of time, the production of drugs, certainly marijuana, but all the other drugs too, has not really been abated. The flow is as plentiful as it was. There is no kid in this country who can't get marijuana if he wants it, much more easily than he can get alcohol, because alcohol, which is permitted, has rules that you can't sell to minors, and the people who do the selling are not about to risk losing their license by doing so. So unless they're getting it from their own homes, it's not easy to get alcohol, but it's very easy to get marijuana because the law can't touch it. The law can't touch it because it's outside the law, and it's outside the law because we're trying to prohibit it. The lesson of all of this is that you can never prohibit, certainly not by legislation and law enforcement, the production, sale, distribution, or consumption of any substance that people want. Cannot be done. In fact, the effort to do so enhances the production and the sale and the distribution because it so vastly increases the profitability. That is no less true for drugs today of all kinds than it was true for alcohol. Moreover, the collateral consequences are enormous. You generate violence, you fund a criminal enterprise. I have often thought that there's a kind of a political and economic codependency between prison guards, cops, and drug lords, because they are the only groups that systematically benefit from what is the largest government subsidization of an industry in this country. The one thing that is absolutely clear, as clear about current intoxicants as it was about alcohol, is that you can never control and regulate what you are trying to prohibit. Because when you try to prohibit it, you place it outside the reach of the law, you can't tax it, you can't regulate its control, its quality. The same way in which alcohol was adulterated, so today other drugs are adulterated, and with the same destructive effects on the users. You end up outlawing clean needles so that drug injection becomes the principal way of keeping the AIDS epidemic going. And efforts to legislate the provision of clean needles are met with resistance because of drug hysteria. Kids who are terminally ill with cancer cannot get morphine because hospitals have limitations on how much morphine they can give, and because the parents are even afraid that the kids are going to become addicted. These kids are 10 years old and soon to die. That is how hysterical the drug regime has gotten in this country. So the question arises, Why is it that the lessons of alcohol prohibition, which were exactly the same lessons, were learned so quickly, and why alcohol prohibition went away in 13 years, and the drug prohibition has stayed with us for all the other intoxicants, primarily marijuana of all of them, and gone up and escalated, and is escalating still as we speak? Why should that be? Why were these lessons not learned? They're exactly the same lessons with exactly the same consequences. The answer, I believe, is race. Let me give you a little bit of the racial disparity and the racial targeting behind these statistics. You know those New York arrests I was talking about? 85% of them are black. 80% of the people who use marijuana in New York are white. My kids in the neighborhoods where I live do not see those kinds of stops and frisks and those kinds of arrests. It happens almost exclusively in minority communities. That's where the cops do it. They catch a certain kind of fish because they fish, they do their fishing in the waters where those fish swim. The disparity is enormous. 80% of the people who use marijuana in New York are white. 85% of those searched and arrested are black. And if you add Latinos, it's even worse. In the country overall, 13%, this is according to the federal government's own statistics, 13% of all drug users, of all drugs, are black. That is about their percentage in the population. In other words, blacks are not getting disproportionately arrested because more blacks than whites use drugs in general, even the hard drugs. 13% of all monthly drug users are black. 37% of all the arrests are black. 53% of all the convictions are black. And 67%, two-thirds, of all the people sent to prison for these offenses are black. I'm talking now about nonviolent drug offenses, mostly possession. Of those 850,000 annual arrests for marijuana, 88% of them are for simple possession. We are not talking about large-scale trafficking. Now, you see the press conferences every once in a while. You know, you see the pictures of we got this many kilos, we got that many kilos, and you know, we busted this gang and we busted that gang. All of that is like the daily dips in the stock market, but they don't describe the long-term trend, which is that the supply has not been abated, the use has not been abated, the profit has not been abated, the violence has not been abated, but the targets are almost exclusively racial minorities. In New York State, 92% of all the people in prison for nonviolent drug offenses are black or Latino. This is in a state where 80 to 85% of all the users are white. That's true not just for marijuana, it's true for all the other drugs too. It's even true for heroin. It's true for cocaine. When crack was developed, which is a smokable form of cocaine, but which has the same pharmacological effect. It is cocaine. You may get a quicker rush from it, but it basically is the same drug. It has the same pharmacological effect on your body. The criminal sentences for crack possession were 100 times in federal law what they were for powdered cocaine. Powder cocaine was almost exclusively used by whites. Crack cocaine was almost exclusively used by blacks because that's how the criminal enterprises marketed it. These collateral consequences are enormous because we have in this country something called felony disenfranchisement. I don't know how many of you have heard much about that, some of you have, but until, it's a little bit better now than it was, but until 2005, all but two states in this country barred people from voting if they were convicted of a felony. I think Maine was one of them. Now, no other Western industrialized democracy in the world does that or has ever done it. For us, those felony disenfranchisement laws were products of the post-Civil War effort to reject Reconstruction. Blacks were primarily the ones who were disenfranchised, and the felony disenfranchisement laws arose right after the Civil War and became institutionalized, particularly in the South, but really throughout the whole country until it was, say, all but two states. Now, that didn't have much of a political effect until the drug war expanded. In the late 1960s, since there were only 200,000 people in prison, state and federal, for all offenses, for all crimes, the felony disenfranchisement didn't have more than a negligible political effect. But by 2004, nearly 5 million people were barred from voting because of a prior felony conviction. In Florida, you remember Florida. In Florida, in 2004, in 2000, in Florida in 2000, 200,000 blacks were barred from voting because of a prior felony conviction. I'm not talking about the 80,000 blacks who were barred from voting because it was said that they had felonies when they didn't. Forget those. That was fraud. 200,000 were legally barred from voting. Now, this is an election which, in a number that is seared into my memory forever, like the uniform numbers of old Brooklyn Dodgers that I will never forget, 537 disputed votes in Florida decided who was president. Florida had 200,000 blacks that it prevented from voting because of prior convictions of felonies, disproportionately drug offenses, not entirely, but disproportionately. Let's suppose that that slice of the demographic doesn't vote at the same rates that the rest of us do, which they don't. These are people who are convicted of crimes. They don't vote at high rates. Let's say a third of them would have voted. So let's say 70,000 of those 200,000 would have voted if they had been permitted to do so and could have been registered and brought out by the NAACP and whoever else was trying to organize minority voting in those days. About 85% of blacks, particularly poor blacks, vote Democratic. Let's say 80% to be a little conservative. That means that if 70,000 people voted, 56,000 would have voted for Gore and 14,000 for Bush. That's a 42,000 plurality. Let's say only half of that, 20,000. You end up in a landslide in Florida instead of 537 disputed votes, and you have a different president. Felony disenfranchisement did that. Drug felonies were the major contributor to felony disenfranchisement. Nonviolent possession. Two political scientists, I think, at the University of Minnesota published a study in the 1990s, either in the American Political Science Review or the American Sociological Review, I forget which, in which they showed that the reason that John Tower surprisingly gets elected to the Senate from Texas in the 1980s was because of the absence of black votes as a result of felony disenfranchisement. And the same thing with John Warner in Virginia. And they speculate, analyzing these numbers, that if the same numbers of people and the same types of people had been disenfranchised from voting in 1960, when those numbers were small, Richard Nixon beats John Kennedy. The political disenfranchisement of blacks is a direct civil rights consequence of the explosion of drug felonies in this country. 14% of all black men in America are felony disenfranchised today. In the states of the Deep South, it's 30%, 30, 29, 31, 32, right around 30. A third, basically, of black male voters are disenfranchised in the states of the Deep South. Now, if I'm running for office, and I want to win, and you let me bar from voting a third of my opponent's likely voters, I'm going to win most of those elections. If you want to know why the solid South has stayed as solid as it has, if you want to know why that has become the bastion of American fundamentalist politics. You need look no further than the margins of victory that are provided for many elections by the disenfranchisement of black voters because of felony convictions, the dominant piece of which is nonviolent drug offenses. What's worse than that is that those disenfranchised black voters are counted by the states as citizens to enhance their representation in Congress and the number of electoral votes they have. Now, this only happened once before in American history. You know when that was. That's when they decided to count 3/5 of a slave as a person for the purposes of increasing their political power. Well, now we do it one better. We do 5/5 of a person. The whole person is counted. And the citizens of Florida get to have more electoral votes because of the 200,000 black citizens that they do not allow to vote. So you not only tilt the politics in a certain direction, you enhance the power of that tilted politics by counting the people that you've disenfranchised. Now the question is, why does this go on? Why does this still happen? Why? And one of the answers that I speculate is to look at the coincidence of the timing. In 1963, in the March on Washington, Martin Luther King Jr. makes his I Have a Dream speech. And what was his dream? His dream was to get rid of Jim Crow. His dream was to get rid of legalized discrimination in the South and by custom in the North. At that time, all the Jim Crow laws are still in effect. They've been in effect since the end of the Civil War. Jim Crow became a successor system of subjugation to slavery. It was replaced almost immediately, and it succeeded very often brutally in maintaining the same kind of subjugation based on skin color that slavery had. A little less brutal, but still. Jim Crow comes apart in the mid-60s. In 1964, the Civil Rights Act of 64 is passed, which outlaws racial discrimination in public accommodations, hotels, restaurants, swimming pools, and in employment and in education. In 1965, the Voting Rights Act is passed, which outlaws racial discrimination in voting, poll taxes, and the literacy tests, and all that. In 1968, the Fair Housing Act is passed, which outlaws racial discrimination in the sale and rental of homes. Lyndon Johnson, who steers that legislation through in 1964, says afterwards, "Well, that's it. It was the right thing to do, but now the Democrats have lost the South forever." The South, which had been the solid South for the Democrats, and you remember what happened. Strom Thurmond becomes a Republican, and so do all the people who follow him. And for the first time since Reconstruction, Republicans begin to make inroads in presidential elections in the South after 1964. Barry Goldwater runs against Johnson, loses in a landslide, but aside from his home state of Arizona, the only states he wins are some states in the Deep South, which is the first time that that has gone to a Republican candidate since Reconstruction. In 1968, Nixon runs on what he fondly called the Southern Strategy. And he pretty much sweeps the South at the same time that George Wallace is running for president on the same sort of a platform. The South is never Democratic again and dominates the electoral landscape in what then becomes perceived as a shift to the right in American politics, which isn't exactly that if you take away what was going on in the South. So by 1968, the laws are in place that dismantle and deconstruct the legal infrastructure of Jim Crow. It's gone, and it's replaced by a civil rights enforcement legal infrastructure. That's in 1968. The legalized subjugation of blacks is over. In 1969, Nixon is inaugurated, and in 1970, he declares the first war on drugs, and the escalation that I've been describing begins. When you factor in the racial disparity, when you look at the fact that the prisons are now filled and explosively filled with people who violate these laws out of all disproportion, to their violations, but racially targeted. When you look at the fact that outside of Baltimore in the 1990s, 17% of the drivers of cars were black, 73% of them pulled over and searched for drugs were black. That in I-95 in Florida, you were 75 times more likely to have your cars pulled over and searched if you were black than if you were white. And you realize that the Federal Drug Enforcement Agency had a program in those years that brought in state troopers from all the states and taught them how to spot a car that was carrying drugs. And one of the ways you did it is if somebody black was driving an expensive car. So lawyers and BMWs got pulled over, athletes got pulled over, but they never found any drugs. The number of drugs that they found were minuscule because they weren't based on any serious evidence. They were based on the same kind of principle that says, you know, most of the blacks in the NBA, most of the players in the NBA are black, so blacks have a real talent for basketball. So I want to get a basketball team. I'll go out and round up 10 kids on the street who happen to be black. You're not going to get a good basketball team that way, and they didn't find drugs that way either. But that's what happened. And in a very real sense, the racially targeted enforcement of drug prohibition has today become a successor system to the Jim Crow laws it replaced in subjugating blacks, in decimating families, in incarcerating people, in barring them from voting, in a way that most white liberals do not know, do not understand, and do not feel. One of the reasons that there's no political outrage to what I've been describing is that that it's focused on communities which haven't by themselves the capacity to generate that outrage. It doesn't hit us. It doesn't hit our kids. That the kind of rage at those kinds of stop and frisks, those kinds of searches, those kinds of arrests, those kinds of incarceration, if they were happening uniformly in proportion to the people who are actually using these substances, the political resistance would have stopped it long ago. The twin thing that happens with the racial targeting of these kinds of practices is that it ends up subjugating people based on race in a way that nobody recognizes, and it ends up insulating those practices from the political resistance that could end them because it's not affecting most other people. In California this November, there is on the ballot an initiative to legalize marijuana. I'm not talking about medical marijuana now, which has now become legalized in 14 states in the District of Columbia. To legalize marijuana in general and treat it like alcohol, regulate it, regulate the hours that it can be sold, regulate the age as it's sold, tax it, treat it like alcohol. I don't know if that's going to win. It probably won't. My prediction, if you want to write it down and yell at me later, is that it will probably get somewhere between 44 and 51%. It may win. It will probably lose close. But it is part of a pattern that was unthinkable as recently as 5 years ago, and that is beginning to develop some sense of the unworkability, the dysfunction, the counterproductiveness of this regime of drug prohibition. And precisely because most of the drug prohibition is focused on marijuana, it is beginning to gain traction in the larger society for the same reason that the end of alcohol prohibition came, which is too many people used it. That's not true of methamphetamine. It's not true of heroin. It's not true of ecstasy. But if you take marijuana out of the equation, and the reason why law enforcement has so clung to the prohibition of marijuana is if you take it out, there is no drug war left because the total numbers of people using all the other intoxicants together is very small. If you take marijuana out of the equation, the drug war is virtually gone. My view is that it is the responsibility of people like us in rooms like this all over the country who are not directly victimized by everything I've described to find a way to stand shoulder to shoulder with the people who are. For the same reason that the Danish wore yellow stars, because if you allow a repressive regime to isolate its victims and leave you alone, and you do not find a way to stand shoulder to shoulder with those victims, the victimization will continue. Thank you.
We seldom, if ever, get a standing round of applause for a speech like that, like any we've had here, so that shows you how much it's appreciated, Ira. The first question, and you were sort of touching on this at the end, is how do we get from here to there, from today's drug policy to a more rational one?
Well, as always, you know, it's politics. We're not going to win this one through the courts. The problem is that there has been a kind of a bipartisan complicity to these laws throughout. This is not one of those things that you can blame on the conservatives. The drug war flourished as much under Clinton as it did under Bush or Reagan. And it does this at the state level, and it does this at the... If you look at the problems that state legislatures have had just passing medical marijuana, and you see how people line up. One of the things that happens in hysteria is that people come to believe all kinds of crazy things. I mean, we have been subjected to 70 years of government-induced disinformation. When Tom was telling me the other day that he met somebody whom he here in Maine, who he said he was in favor of legalizing marijuana, and she said, but if that happens, what about the children? What about, you know, people will be falling down in the street. People will be, well, of course, they're all using marijuana now. They're not falling down in the street. In the Netherlands, where it's decriminalized, the uses of marijuana among the young have actually gone down. Also in Portugal. Portugal has had drugs decriminalized for 9 years. Nobody even knows about that. And most of these collateral consequences don't exist. So what has to happen, how you get from here to there, is you have to make it safe for your political representatives to vote against this stuff. They do not feel safe. They think that if they start voting against this kind of legislation, they will get kicked out of office. And they're probably right. And the reason that they're right is that there is no counterweight. We can sit around in rooms like this and nod at each other all we want. Until it becomes a political issue that will determine people's votes, until people who vote in legislatures feel that they will have enough support, they will not vote against this stuff. So I think the how you get from here to there answer is the same way you get from here to there on abortion rights, on birth control, on civil rights, on anti-discrimination, on stem cell research, on all of it. You get from here to there with political activity. Do what the Tea Partiers are doing. Get mad and get organized. That's how you get from here to there.
It's commonly believed that marijuana is a precursor to heavier drugs, so that if you were to legalize marijuana, you would end up with more people going from there to cocaine or heroin. Is there any truth to that?
There is no truth to it. The canard of marijuana as the gateway drug means everyone... It's actually based on some research which shows, follow this carefully, that 85% of people who are strung out on heroin used marijuana. Yeah. But that's not the question. Because 85% of people who were strung out on heroin also once drank milk. And they smoked cigarettes, and they drank coffee, and they ate meat. The question isn't what percentage of the people who are strung out on heroin once used marijuana. The question is what percentage of the people who once used marijuana are strung out on heroin. And the answer is almost nobody. The number of people who are alcoholics, severe, dysfunctional, problematic alcoholics in this country, is about 15% of all people who use alcohol. But all of them started out with a glass of wine, just the way you do once in a while. But you don't become an alcoholic because you have a glass of wine with your dinner, or a martini, or maybe even two. So the whole gateway thing is a fiction that is created by the enforcement regime of drug prohibition. The truth is that the opposite happens. When you force kids to buy marijuana from criminals who are also interested in selling them other drugs, they get connected to criminal enterprises. That doesn't happen in a legal regime. The exposure to the other drugs comes about as a consequence of the criminalization of the marketing. Crack was an invention of the criminal market that never would have occurred, if cocaine were legalized and regulated. Many people use cocaine. I mean, think about what heroin is. Heroin is roughly equivalent to morphine. It's the same thing. People take morphine in hospitals all the time, sometimes for 2 weeks at a time, sometimes heavy. They don't come out addicted, because the nature of addiction itself is a fictionalized, problematic concept. Addiction depends not just on the substance you're putting into yourself, but on who you are, on what your psychological makeup is, and the setting in which you do it. Think of gambling addiction. Gambling addiction has all of the characteristics of heroin addiction or alcoholism, without a substance. Why is that? It's because what determines whether or not you have a problematic, compulsive, self-destructive relationship to something is not just the pharmacology of the drug. So all of that stuff that is talked about the gateway drug and the fact that kids are going to... And in the places of this world where it is available, it doesn't happen. That is evidence that nobody wants to talk about, and that it is not easy to find. But go and study what's happened in the Netherlands, and you'll see the answer to that question.
Okay, I'm going to try to tie it into foreign policy. Would you speculate on some of the foreign policy implications of legalizing drugs in the United States, for example, in Mexico, Latin America, or Afghanistan?
Well, you know... at least as much, probably more than I, about all of this. But the fact of the matter is that unlike alcohol prohibition, drug prohibition is a global prohibition system enforced by treaties, which this country has been insistent upon having everybody sign. There is no country in the world that does not, on the books, prohibit drugs. Some of them ignore their own laws and decriminalize it, not legalize it, by basically allowing, coffee shops in Amsterdam to sell marijuana cakes. But all of the laws, 100% of the countries are, and in places like Afghanistan, Mexico now, because it's so close to us, but Colombia for years, lots of places like that, they have destroyed the government. The criminal gangs have become so lavishly funded as they are by the artificially enhanced profits, have become virtually private armies that are strong enough to contest police forces and even the military of these countries. If you talk to some of the ex-presidents of Mexico, several of them have now come out in favor of legalization and are even issuing press releases telling the voters in California to legalize this stuff because it's making it impossible. We have become complicit, I think, we the United States, in undermining and destroying democratic institutions in many countries where this has happened. And I think that the globalization of the prohibition, like when it's targeted with blacks in the ghetto, nobody pays attention to it. When it's happening over in Colombia someplace or in Afghanistan, if there's not another reason to bring it to our attention, it doesn't feel like the damage. But the damage is getting close to home now on the border between the Southwest and the United States and Mexico. And something close to 30,000 people have been killed recently, 10 times more in that drug war than we have lost soldiers in Iraq since the beginning of that war.
Unfortunately, we have to cut it off here because, as I say, Ira's got to catch a plane. But this has been absolutely fascinating. It's been a real eye-opener to me, and I'm sure to all of you. So this is kind of a modest token of our appreciation. It's the famous, it is well known, Ira.
Very.
It's the famous Midcoast Mogollon Foreign Relations from Rockport, Maine.
There's no
substance. There's nothing. I'm sorry. I'm sorry. Thank you.
You've been listening to Ira Glasser, president of the Drug Policy Alliance, and a speech he gave recently in Camden before the Midcoast Forum on Foreign Relations on Speaking in Maine. If you missed part of the program or would like to hear it again, you can find it online at mpbn.net. Look under the On Demand tab for Audio On Demand, where you'll find this program and an archive of past Speaking in Maine programs, available to stream online or to download as podcasts. A service made possible by member support. Charles Beck is the executive producer of our program. For Speaking in Maine, I'm your producer and host, Gordon Fellis.